take a minute to check your social battery. How's it doing? It's easy to ignore our needs and spread ourselves too thin. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/popcastpod today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/popcastpod.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your If I Could Write 12,000 Lines of Music, News, and Criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica.
When I say celestial, I mean extraterrestrial. I mean accepting the alien you reject.
No, that's not static playing in the background. That's not a radio off in the distance. That is Spud Infinity, and that is off the new Big Thief album, which is called Dragon New Warm Mountain. I believe in you. Okay, so if you follow Popcast, you know, we might have mentioned in the past, Big Thief is a band that I personally find challenging. My colleagues also find challenging. And, you know, we have largely just kind of like let the Big Thief phenomenon unfold and tried to observe it from a distance and kind of scratch heads every now and again. But I'll be honest, as a critic, it is unsatisfying to effectively recuse yourself from the critical discourse about a record or an artist. And so lately, especially around the release of this album a few weeks ago, I've been thinking like, okay, what should I do? I didn't feel the need to like review the record straight ahead. I thought about maybe engaging with it and writing about what it's like to really, really not be able to parse something that a lot of people that you like and respect seem very excited about. And then I realized, like, I can have it both ways, right? Like, we can do an episode of Popcast. We can bring on people who care quite a bit. And much like we did with the Tame Impala episode a few years ago, not like the Tame Impala was maybe a little bit more tense, where I was like, convince me this band's not bad. That's not exactly what I want to do here. But I feel like I want to have a conversation about what it is about this band that is appealing to those who are fascinated by it and also potentially cause revulsion in me. And in order to do that, I wanted to bring folks on who have written seriously about Big Thief. So we're going to have two guests. John Dolan from Rolling Stone is here. Sam Sadomski from Pitchfork is here. And we're going to get into the weeds. I'm going to talk about my personal biases. I assume they are going to explain away why they hold this band in favor. And I've talked a little bit to John prior to this about kind of like what level of overranking Big Thief might be currently subjected to. We're going to talk about indie rock messiah complexes and the genre as a whole and what it is lacking and how someone can come to occupy so much space in it in such a relatively short period of time. And maybe at the end of the episode, I don't know, maybe I'll feel differently. Probably not. But sometimes it's important to gut check yourself and to allow others to body check you a little bit. So that's what we're going to get into this week. First, Sam Sadomski is here. Sam is an associate editor at Pitchfork and recently interviewed the band and Adrian Linker at length. Sam, first time on Popcast. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
A gift to have you. Also, John Dolan is here. John is the reviews editor at Rolling Stone. John, first of all, welcome to Popcast.
Thank you.
A shame that we have not had John Dolan on Popcast before. As listeners know, anytime someone who I've known for a long time or has in any way affected my career comes on the show, I have to lightly embarrass them and by extension, embarrass myself. John, back in the day, was a reviews editor at Spin Magazine. This is in the mid-2000s, I believe, and was generous enough to give me a bunch of work. But there's one particularly memorable thing, and I actually don't know, John, if this has stuck with you at all. So Before I was freelancing widely, I mostly wrote for Rat magazines. I wrote for XXL, The Source, Vibe, Herb, smaller magazines, etc. Writing for Rolling Stone and later Spin is when I started writing more broadly. And I always had low-key anxiety about that. Now, obviously, I write about a whole bunch of stuff. I've taught myself about all the various histories of all the various musics, every music. I know all the history. But at that time, it still felt touch and go. And John, you assigned me a lead review of those. Remember when Bright Eyes put out two albums at once, or three albums?
Yes, I remember this review. I remember this assignment. Absolutely.
That was a very meaningful thing to me. It was meaningful that you extended your trust to me to write about something that was not necessarily...
It was a little different for you. That's right. Yeah.
It was a little different. It was meaningful that you extended that platform, that trust to someone who... I mean, if there's one thing we know about Spin magazine writers, they loved them some Bright Eyes. So I was maybe not the obvious choice for that. However, I always appreciated it. I carried it with me. And now I think we can all collectively say that you are partially responsible for unleashing me onto the masses in this fashion. So thank you. And John, would you like to apologize to everybody?
I would like to just say, you're welcome, world, because I think that was a great record review, as I recall. And look what it's done. Here, we've taken you from Bright Eyes to Big Thief, and there's definitely a connection there, too. So
big facts. Big facts for the biggest thief.
I was going to ask, did you like those Bright Eyes albums? Was it a positive?
I remember it being kind of like in the B plus to B range. John, does that sound about right?
I think at this point in the Spin review, I think we were
like sevens.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I think it was 1 through 10.
So maybe in the seven.
We negotiated to a seven, but...
Like a seven or maybe a 7 and a 6, kind of?
Yeah, something like that. I mean, we didn't have the advantage of the 7.4s and this...
That's right.
6.8s, which was a brilliant contrivance of a certain publication. And so we only had, but it was better than the old Spin system in the 90s, which was red light, green light, yellow light.
Cheating over there at Pitchfork with the decimal places, but that's all right.
But I think that's a good system.
Oh, no, it's a good system. It's just, look, I'm old enough to remember when there was just a thumbs up and a thumbs down,
You had to make the hard calls. It's true.
Yeah, this is exactly right. So anyway, grateful for that. Bright Eyes, also a tremendous transition to get us talking about Big Thief, a band which got its start on Saddle Creek Records. A once mighty label. Apologies. There's going to be a lot of apologizing on this episode. I want to say that up front. It is all going to come from me. So I should also clarify, the reason that I've chosen John and Sam is both to offer breadth of history, longstanding critical perspective, and also a fundamental empathy towards this band that I myself have struggled with. Let's just jump right in. Let's get right in, man. Now, John, you reviewed this album for Stone, a beautiful mid to long review, 3.5 out of 5. First of all, we have to say the album is called Dragon New Warm Mountain, I Believe in You. John, we emailed a little bit about this. One of the things that I find most challenging about the Big Thief discourse is the intensity of the fervor and the kind of shock of someone potentially not enjoying Big Thief. And it feels very overwrought to me. We emailed a little bit about this. When you listen to Big Thief, and especially, this album or dating back to the previous albums, does this strike you as a band that would be capable of generating this degree of fervor?
Well, it's interesting. I feel like there are sort of four categories of Big Thief reception. The first is the one you just alluded to, which is this almost kind of religious.
Messianic.
Yes. I think it was Vulture's piece was The Miracle of Big Thief. It's a miracle this happened. This band, it's incredible. But
the only thing miraculous is my whip. Let's just put it be honest. Let's be honest about this.
So that, of course, is going to engender, I think, two other responses. One of which is, no, that's wrong. They suck. Which you can get like this sort of, internet reaction, which you have to absolutely get. It's either got to be one or the other. It's got to be either or. And then there's the thing you're talking about, this sort of thing that I really find pretty easy to sort of, even though I don't share it, I understand it, which is, and I've heard it from other people too, a lot of people I respect and friends of mine who say, what's happening here? I mean, like, I don't get that at all. My position, which I feel is the most reasonable position, the position I land at is, of course, is position number 4, which is they're good. They make good records. We're a fine band. That's like, you know, they do lots of things well. They have a good singer-songwriter leading the band, a good singer. They have a good guitar player. They've put out now 5 records, 3 of which I really like, 2 of which I don't like as much. If we want to get into the recording history of the whole band, of the whole sort of their story or whatever. But I guess I find myself kind of in your camp, but as a fan.
First of all, I just want to say for all our listeners, John Dolan has just taxonomized that ass. Just for the record. So you have been taxonomized. I don't know where in the taxonomy you are, but wherever you are, you have been taxonomized. Sam, where are you in the taxonomy?
That's funny. I mean, hearing you describe it, it definitely rings true. I mean, like, I'm a lifelong Springsteen fan, so I have a lot of room for messiahs, definitely.
I feel, you know, you make a good point. They're kind of in the Jay-Z, Beyonce, Springsteen, kind of like, that's like, but I would say with those, I understand the emotional logic of like Springsteen, Beyonce, Jay-Z, like these were totemic figures, obviously, and the people who loved them for really, I understand the emotional logic of that, I guess I'm saying. Where does Big Thief, how do we get to the miracle of Big Thief?
Yes. And we should say, so let's just, from a time frame perspective, and Sam, you can fill it in a little bit, but I just want to do the big sketch. The first Big Thief album comes out 2016, so 6 years ago. The album that just came out is the 5th album. It's long. It could be a double album. Maybe it's a double. I don't know. I don't know what the math is. I don't know what the Nielsen math
20
is.
20 songs.
It's a long, yeah. I mean, you know, it's a fabulous DJ Clune mixtape, really. But the real transformative moment, I think, with Big Thief really comes in 2019 when there's the 2 albums, and that's UFOF and 2 Hands. And that's when I start seeing pieces. And John, to your point, there are people you really respect who are kind of like, I don't get it. And my experience is the opposite. There's people I really respect who are like, I bang with this super hard. There's like a big Gia Tolentino piece from that era where I'm just like, what are you hearing? Like, you know, Gia is someone I like personally and I respect her taste. And I'm also just like, I don't know what's happening here.
I mean, I have thoughts. I kind of do think what I have a sense of what happened. And I think it was that 2019, that first of those 2 records.
So Sam, like, talk us through, and to John's point, how did we get to Masterpiece? How did we get to open worship awe?
Their first record is called Masterpiece. So maybe that's,
yeah. Oh, okay. Problem. Sorry. It was
self-fulfilling.
Written. It was, yeah, right. Yeah.
Taking it back, I feel like the first people I heard who had that sort of effusive excitement about this band were musicians, like people I knew in Brooklyn who were like, there's this band who's been playing, and, you know, they would talk about Adrienne's, like, how prolific she was and how every show was new music and the interplay, you know, the fact that this band had such a specific dynamic that, you know, you would go and you could spend a whole show just like watching James, the drummer, play. You know, he's so charismatic and it's such a distinct style. But yeah, I would definitely agree. It was like those 2019 records. Preparing for this, I like revisited the whole catalog and listening back to the first 2, which I really like those records, but it was kind of interesting to hear. They were basically like a fairly standard indie rock band with maybe like a slight country influence. Like there's songs on there, like Interstate, that, you know, I heard it and I was like, oh, you know what? It sounds kind of like Pavement. Like,
that's right. Exactly.
Like doing that sort of 90s thing that a lot of bands in the 2010s were doing.
A more contained, more conventional band in 2016.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I think by like UFOF, the sound of the record was so distinct. Like, to me, that record is all about the acoustic guitar finger picking and the drumming, like the way James Krivchenia finds ways to accompany her playing. And there's just something so different about it and just such a specific texture and emotional tenor to it that makes critics use words like miracle, you know?
Okay, can we listen to something? What's a good emblematic song off UFOF that really nails the shift from the first 2 records?
I would say
that
the song Cattails.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
It jumped out as just, this is wonderful.
Okay, so Sam, like you, and when I say revisited, that's maybe an overstatement, but I went back and listened to all of the records to the best of man's ability.
One man's ability, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Or one boy's ability, Brad. And I actually landed in a stranger place. I found myself more charmed by Masterpiece than I remembered because it was more contained than the records I sort of intensely dislike. And so by the time you get to the two 2019 records, I'm actually kind of like, I'm out. I don't want any part of this. I'm out. And then paradoxically, the more I listen to the new one, even though I do find it grating and irritating, there are more moments on the new record. It's a shaggier record. It's a less shaped record. Whatever the production, I know it's produced by James. It doesn't feel as produced, which is, of course, a choice of production. To me, it maybe does better things for the songwriting and singing than the tighter production on the earlier records. That's how it left me by the third time that I listened to this record, which is, again, for me, a lot. I found myself lightly opening up to it. John, where do you feel like this most recent album, what is the innovation or the storytelling that they're trying to put forth that's different from the 2019 era?
I think you kind of got at it where this one is, I think the sort of historical touchstone would be something like the Basement Tapes, where it's, you know, the band and Bob Dylan, and the sense of kind of overabundant song splurge, kind of self-discovery, just like, let's try this, let's try this, let's try this. And there's a sense of looking in on them, creating it in real time, kind of as they go, which I think is very appealing to people. There's also, I think, on this album, which is nice, I think in the early ones, I felt they were more of like a more rugged, more kind of hard-bitten, like almost Rilo Kiley kind of with more damage a little bit. And like this one, you can really hear this progression on all these records to a real sense of contentment. I mean, most of the songs on here are love songs. They're often very sweet. I mean, there's still moments of kind of distress or whatever, but there's something I think about the sense of kind of being in their world on this one. And it reminds me a lot of, like I said, like, you know, the Dylan, the band, Fairport Convention, these kind of things where you feel like you're listening to people who live together, who are making this music in the kitchen or whatever. And I think that's a fun, you know, even when the music doesn't necessarily sound that way, when it's electric or when there's like a drum machine in one song or whatever, it's, I think, really compelling to people that way. And it's fun, you know, after a long time of sort of feeling, you know, isolated and away from each other. And though I didn't, you know, want to bring this up because every review doesn't have to be about COVID, but obviously there's a sense of their pod is a community, and the sense of community really comes through on this one, where the other ones seem more, like you say, more built in the studio. And I think still in a really affecting way for me, but I think this is what you get with this. And I do think that that feeling of kind of throwing stuff, like almost like, you know, another Untouchable might be something almost like Sandinista, where it's the 15th best song on the record, maybe shouldn't have been on there, but it's not too bad. And if they hadn't done it, you know, you wouldn't have it. And like, you know, I mean, maybe they should have broken this up into two, which I kind of suggest in my thing, but I kind of like it this way. And I keep finding things I like. And I gave it not a really super passionate star rating, mainly knocking it down for the title. I mean, you've got a 20-song indie folk record called Dragon New Warm Mountain, I Believe in You That Doesn't Suck. That is a triumph in itself. And I think this record really does kind of have these moments I keep finding. I was just listening to it right now before we came on here, and I'm like, there are songs I keep finding that I'm like, this is wonderful. So I'm going to probably think it's a 4-star by, or 4.5 stars by, like,
by the end of podcast.
Yeah. Now. Yeah, exactly.
Now, to kind of pick up on the intimacy thing and the sense that, like, these are people moving as a unit, what came up for me on a few moments on this record is like a Gillian Welch and David Rawlings kind of energy, where I'm just like, I feel like these people maybe only talk to each other. And they've developed like some kind of like pigeon language that only makes sense within the foursome that like we're still parsing out here. It does feel deeply intercommunicative. And I guess that is the part of this record that I find most reassuring, even if a lot of the fundamental component parts remain vexing to me.
There's a flute solo. There's a Jew's harp solo. It's like these are people who are letting themselves, you know, kind of go and wander off and see where they go and see where they end up. And if you want to wade into that world, I think you will come out of it improved.
Sam, tell me where you feel this record places among the earlier records, and how do you feel about it narratively as far as this point in their career?
Well, in some ways, I would say it's my favorite of the records, and just the sense that each one they've put out, I've kind of felt like is their most ambitious or their biggest. Like, one thing I noticed when I was re-listening to their records is there's this really specific way that they structured those first four records, where it's kind of like, it's like a tent pole thing where there are these huge towering moments, or what someone less sympathetic to the music might hear as like attempts at like a big towering moment. And then the songs in between them build the tension or release the tension or whatever. And like on each of those records, I feel like those attempts got so much bigger and so much bolder, so that by the time you get to Two Hands, which was the previous record, to me, like that song Not, which is like this huge anthemic song where it's like, if you look up any YouTube video of it, it's going to sound different and Adrienne is going to be like screaming her way through it. But with this record, what immediately stood out to me and what I'm still really taken with is the fact that they completely like tore up that playbook. Like there are songs on this that I think are some of the best songs they've done, like Little Things, especially I think is a masterpiece.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
This came up a little bit a couple of episodes ago. We were talking about Mitski and the sense that like artists that maybe are naturally most inclined towards or gifted at a small, intimate sound sometimes are encouraged either by, you know, industry forces or by fan worship or whatever to move towards bigger ideas, bigger sound, bigger production. And it doesn't always serve them. Does Big Thief seem like a band that would benefit from, in essence, less intervention? Not that I think that they have a lot of intervention, but based on what we've seen on these five albums, is this a band that should just be left to its own devices and kind of like, yeah, you guys, great. Go back into the woods, come back in a year. Like, just don't talk to anybody.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they've now had kind of, I'd almost say maybe three distinct sounds, really. And each of them has worked out pretty well. Songwriting, I think, it's changing and improving. And I think musically, they're trying different things and it usually, you know, goes fine. So I don't think there's a real, I mean, they've shown that they can kind of change effectively while keeping the sort of same core things that you like about them, which is all you really want your favorite band to do.
So more apologies, more biases. Indie rock, as we once thought about it, indie rock in the era where John Dolan risked it all and allowed me to review Bright Eyes records. But indie rock is not, I would say, at a particularly robust place right now. Is there some need to kind of lionize a band, to kind of like point at something and be like, that, finally, that, like in this drought, we have this, and this is Big Thief, and maybe it's earned or maybe it's not earned. Do you think there's anything like that at play in terms of the more intense fandom, which obviously I see talking about it on Twitter and who sometimes at me, don't at me, just stop that. But, you know, is there any of that at play, bigger genre forces, this kind of like empty, you know, nature abhors a vacuum and so does indie rock?
To answer the first part, I personally don't feel like there's been a drought. Like, I think there's a lot of cool stuff going on. But I think, like, the thing with Big Thief is that in waves, these bands kind of exist to, I'm not saying this is all of the appeal to Big Thief, but I'm saying like it is an element of it where they sort of crystallize a lot of influences that have been bubbling under the surface for a while. Kind of like the same way like when Animal Collective started using like samplers and people were like, you know, it was like they were referencing like J Dilla and like Daft Punk and like that kind of felt new for an indie band. I kind of feel like Big Thief brings in a lot of those, like the jam band thing. Like they're like, let's face it, there's parts of this record that just straight up sound like the Grateful Dead, which if you're into that is awesome. But also like the country stuff, you know, like John Prine and Iris DeMent are big touchstones for them. And then it's funny, we talked about Bright Eyes, but I feel like a lot of people who were at a formative age when people like Bright Eyes were around, like those songwriters now are kind of like hitting their stride. And Big Thief, I hear like a band who like, you know, you can tell that Joanna Newsom and like Elliot Smith and Wilco, like all of these kind of mid-2000s artists who are now kind of in like a legacy, well, you know, like a like touchstones for younger acts. I hear that in their music too. So I don't know if it's that people needed an indie rock band to like pin their hopes to so much as like they just happened to be the band at the moment that was crystallizing all this stuff that a lot of people were talking about and that a lot of the cycle was kind of bringing back up to the surface maybe.
I'm really glad you mentioned Animal Collective because I did have Animal Collective on my mind a bit when I was listening to the most recent record, and I wouldn't have nailed the thing that you did, which is when Animal Collective emerged, it felt on some level sui generis, but it really was an acknowledgement that people who were being raised in those kinds of like, you know, warehouse show communities, punk squat communities, whatever, were also listening more broadly, more synthesizer music, maybe even techno or dance music, and finding ways to kind of like integrate that into what we think of as like an indie practice or ideology. And Animal Collective ends up kind of like making that stew all seem very, very appealing. And I think that's a super astute way of thinking about this record, that all those touchstones you mentioned, they're all there. This is the band that maybe is doing the best or most effective or the loudest job at syncretizing them.
Yeah, and they're also doing it with such consistency where it's like, if you're a fan of the band, there's always going to be new music to hear and solo albums. And yeah, like talking about it as a world, it's like, it sounds hyperbolic, but they really do make enough music that you can totally, I don't know, like devote yourself to just spending a lot of time listening to it.
I'd like to play briefly just one song on the new record that had maybe even like a touch, maybe like a hidden touch of Animal Collective. It's all one more. I'm making that up. But anyway, it's Heavy Bend. It's After Little Things, which we played earlier. Let's listen to a little bit of Heavy Bend. This isn't a band that like does a lot for me rhythmically, but this was one song where I said, okay, they are aware for them. And you know, everybody's going to say the drumming's great. I get it. I hear you. You are held. You are held and seen. It's just not for me. That's okay. Anyway, moving on. John, what do you think about, you know, Sam says he thinks indie rock is doing fine, and I'm curious to hear more about that. But John, what do you think about the bigger question about filling a potential gap in the emotional marketplace of indie rock?
I would agree with Sam that I think indie rock is, you know, we're indie rock fans, obviously, we think it's doing fine. And I think it is. You see this sort of a similar sort of response to Mitski. But I think getting back to that UFOF record, I think when that came out, there was a sense of them, a real sense of just, and I think it was actually happening of like, you know, transcendence, where it was, you know, the way, like, you know, like you mentioned, the finger picking and the sort of like way that her voice became an instrument in the music and this kind of meditative, it almost did feel like them like pulling something kind of mystical together, and it had almost like a modern Astral Weeks-ish kind of quality to it that I think really was the thing that people thought, like, this really does, this feels, you know, getting back to this religious idea, like really did feel transcendent. And, you know, it comes up in her theme. She sings a lot about, you know, she sings about mortality. She sings about some of these things that would sort of lend well, like, you know, it's, I think lyrically she does a good job of combining the sensibility of the lyrics and the sensibility of the music fit together very, very well. And I think that, like, taking, like you say, taking these kind of, going back, you know, in the sort of freak folk canon, but also going back to the Harry Smith anthology and things like that, and John Fahey and things like that, and making them feel, combining them with 90s indie rock, and, you know, especially the kind of slower sort of, like, you know, Codeine, Slint. They have a song on UFOF that sounds like Glow. Then kind of making that seem modern. And another huge thing about this that I think makes them popular, especially in what you call the Spotify core era, there's still brevity. Even when they're doing something weird or trippy, it's 4 minutes, it's 3 minutes. The attention economy thing is there. It's like, you're not going to have a 9 minute song. Not that you couldn't, and not that people wouldn't love it, but I think the sort of like, there's a pop sensibility here. There's a sense of they're good at brevity, concision. And that's something that matters a lot when you're like, you know, shooting around Spotify.
In your review, I'm pretty sure you invoked, you know, Old Weird America as something that is a touchstone for them. And I think that's probably in part kind of, you know, you kind of like to hop from there to like whatever Welch and Rawlings things I'm thinking of.
They do something I like, and I like when bands do this, when the music sounds old timey, but the lyrics are referencing things. Like she's got the line about sit down and watch TV, romance, like on our phone, watch TV, romance, action, mystery. Like we're just going to watch Netflix. It's like, I like,
yeah, I think she has the line, I want to be the vape that gets you high.
Yeah,
too.
The thing about the sleeping together on a plane, and we're going to be sleeping together on a plane.
That's a future line.
Yeah, right. Totally. I mean, I really just generally think that's a sweet way to, you know, do old timey music. It's like, it's our experience. And there's still beautiful lines. And there's a great line about, we have to put on the fireplace because we're losing like money on heat because I can see the windows fogging up. Like this really kind of sweet everyday stuff that comes from her experience that still, when the music sounds like it could have been made 50, 60 years ago, you know, I think that hits home. They kind of get you coming and going in a lot of ways.
Can we talk a little bit about Adrian Lenker's voice? Because there's a direct line from this old Americana, the aestheticizing of old Americana, to how she delivers vocally, and also maybe chat a little bit about the Lenker solo work. You know, I think for among the people I know who find it challenging to get an entry point into Big Thief, the particular quaver of the voice is a real challenge. And I wonder, how does the voice strike you? And also, I had a whole kind of like thing I was going to write about what it's like to really not like something that other people like, which obviously is like criticism 101, but it's really been on my mind. And I spent a lot of time when I was listening to this really trying to like parcel out all the micro details that I was really finding challenging. And one of them is the particular tone of the voice. What is it about the voice that presumably works for you? And it is so signature. I'm sure you also see how it could be a wall for some.
Her songwriting and singing is straight ahead folky. The more I do tend to tune out. I like it when they sort of have these things working in conversation a little bit. I felt like you're right that I think early on the country twang is the sort of more hard-bitten country singing really, I think, went well with the guitar playing they had, which was kind of heavier. And they've kind of gone away from that. There isn't much of that left in their music. I have not gone as deep into her solo stuff. I've listened to it a little. That's a little bit of a place where I kind of personally also kind of end up stopping a little bit. But I felt like the singing, it's interesting. She's been kind of a lot of different kind of singers in a certain sense. Singing on UFOF it's prettier. I mean, it's just, you know, it's really
like more kind of like conventionally prettier.
Yeah. I mean, and just like using her voice as an instrument and almost like post kind of like, you know, not as into sort of language, although the lyrics are really good, but like, how does this kind of interact with these sounds? And I think that's the singing on that record is quite good. And it actually does kind of bring to mind a little bit of like a 60s Van Morrison.
I think that's a good point with, and like the Van comparison, because something with Adrian, I'm not necessarily listening to in terms of storytelling, like a vocalist delivering a story that I'm following along with. A lot of her lyrics to me read more like imagery overload, kind of like a collage of scenes and language.
There are themes and things you can pull out, but it's not, you know, if you try to find the narrative, it's elusive.
To your point earlier about the brevity of the songs and also the kind of the pop instinct that's lurking underneath this, there is narrative on some of these songs, but I do not experience them as full storytelling adventures. They feel like they feel more impressionistic.
This record as you read the lyrics, and I think you do have to read her. And I did this before. It's like most of them seem to be relatively straightforward love songs.
Well, you know, nothing I love more than reading along. Well,
yeah, I know. I love to read my record. I want to read my record.
Minute,
yeah,
right. Yeah, an 80 minute album. I barely can read like a New Yorker Talk of the Town anymore. Like my brain is so broken.
I want my record to have subtitles. It's very important that I can.
Jean-Luc Big Thief here. Yeah. Jeez.
But like going with the like collage like aspect of it, I think because of that, her voice doesn't feel like an affectation to me. And because of that, I think I have a lot of tolerance for the eccentricities of it, because there's so much going on to focus on, and there's so many different textures and emotions interacting in the music. I think that if she was doing like, if she was singing like a standard or something, I mean, I do think she has a really awesome voice, but I think like the way it's treated in the music gives it a lot of room to become a texture, like you said earlier, John, or to complement the story. On this record in particular, like I was so taken with the vocals on little things where she's like making noises and like like that kind of stuff. That seemed playful in it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, she's really good at keying off the guitar in a way that, like, on all these records.
And the drums.
Yeah. That guy's really, I mean, they're really subtle. I mean, some of these sort of meditative, subtle songs on all these records stand out as some of the most, you know, powerful.
James, a drummer, produced this album. And we talked a little bit about how this album is different from prior ones. But do you think there's something specific to the fact that it is the drummer who is producing this record? Is there something about what he was doing on prior records that then all of a sudden manifests in a much more powerful way on this record now that he's got the keys?
I would say that one thing that Sam brought up recently was, or just a minute ago, was the Wilco thing. And I think the drummer as someone who's also making music himself and not just playing the beat and is something. They're all, you know, musical interaction is a real big part of this. And I think in the Wilco comparison is great in that sense. And I think that helps. They're a rhythm band in a lot of ways. They're a meditative band. They're a band that, like, you know, likes circular patterns and things like that. And that's great for that kind of music because the guitar player is fantastic too. So yeah, I think that, I mean, I didn't know the drummer produced it, but now that I think about it, that makes a ton of sense.
So wild. You hear you call them a rhythm band. I just so totally don't experience them that way. My ideas about rhythm are obviously,
I mean, not all the time.
No, I know. It's just funny. But that's why I wanted y'all on the show. Because
that's the Animal Collective too, and the Grateful Dead. It's like, you know, that those are good. Oh, those rhythm are good touchstones. Yeah.
Well, first of all, Animal Collective, obviously a rhythm band. Grateful Dead, another band that I could take or leave. Sorry. Again, apologies to everybody. But I understand them as a rhythmic band. This is a band that I feel like it causes me personally arrhythmia. So, you know, it's just fascinating.
Here again, all week. Yeah.
Yes. No, but again, that's why I wanted y'all here, because like I want to hear this discourse. Like y'all talking about this, it's fascinating to me.
I'm curious, you've spoken about it a little, but what to you is like the cross to bear with this band? What do you hear?
Personally?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's a couple things. I think there's the musical and there's the extra musical, right? Let's start with the extra musical, which is ungenerous, but is real. I tend to resist messianic narratives. So the fervor in the way that it did not line up with my like listening experience, I try to listen very widely. I have fairly broad taste. I have liked bands that are in this rough wheelhouse before. So, you know, I'm generally open to the idea that, like, if a bunch of people I think are smart say that such and such artist is cool, I can usually figure out why they think it's cool, even if I don't personally love it. This is a band that I was really struggling with in the sense I really didn't like the music, and also I couldn't even, like, validate. It's like I couldn't verify it. I couldn't fact check it. It just didn't seem that way. That's extra musical. Musical itself, I do struggle with the tone of the voice. I think a lot of the stuff, like, we're talking about other bands that, to me, like, you want to talk about the Dead or even Wilco, another band I don't particularly like, but I understand the kind of rich, ornate quality of a Wilco album or a good Wilco, quote-unquote good Wilco album. I felt like there's a bunch of, like, paint splatter here and not in the fun way. It feels decentralized to me.
I think that's fair. I mean, that's not unreasonable. But, you know, John, we in the Big Thief community really admire you for doing the work. Yeah. And it's important to do the work. That's what it's really about. And we really thank you. That. Brooklyn indie rock hippies need allies too, and the fact that you're willing to do the work to step out.
Sunday night.
Totally. I didn't know we were supposed to talk about that. Caremonica After Dark.
It's Podcast After Dark, like for real. Like you think we're punchy. It's Podcast After Dark, and I'm talking about Big Thief. So you know it's Lidington in here.
This is actually an intervention.
Is that you guys in the hallway? Are you knocking on the door right now?
You know, I'm actually kind of curious. Caremonica, what is your indie rock safe space? Like, where do you go when you're like, this is the kind of indie rock I like?
First Waxahachie album.
because that is not that far from this.
I understand, but also Katie is a singer that I find like eminently more pleasurable.
Well, and probably a more songwritery songwriter too.
Yeah, and exactly, like an image-based songwriter.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, she's like Lucinda Williams. It's a different kind of, yeah.
Absolutely, and frankly, like in a weird way, she certainly grew into Lucinda Williams, and I almost prefer before it was totally like hovering as a cloud, you know, but when it was still kind of like a loose idea. But to me, like, first Waxahachie record, I can listen to that four times a day, every single day, and feel completely at peace. And I think that's why, like, I am doing the work, you know, we jest, but I am trying to do the work because I think it's interesting as a critic, and we are all critics, to try to understand where something falls short. And on some level, it could be endemic to the thing itself. And on another level, it's like, well, okay, what am I bringing to the record that's causing a block? Where, like, what earplugs, what earwax am I dealing with? And I still can't quite get around this. But you're right, the records that I like, that I would go to for comfort, are not radically different from this. Tony Scott was on a few weeks ago talking about the narcissism of small differences. I would argue that this is the terrorism of small differences.
The burden of small differences. I like.
Yes. Yeah. And that's why I wanted to have this conversation, even though I had been resisting writing about Big Thief. I've been resisting even doing an episode about Big Thief. But I also think every now and again, you have to interrogate your own walls as a critic and kind of try to understand why they're built, and can you do something to dismantle them?
Something that I think is interesting is that, like, we've been talking about the band for like a while now, and I feel like Adrienne's whole like cult of personality thing and like her background and origin story, which is pretty wild, it like now just kind of feels like a footnote to conversations about the band.
Talk us through it.
Well, my coworker Jill Mapes, I think she wrote the first piece and it was awesome. It was like an as told to you, basically, because the story itself is so wild. But basically, she was like born into a religious cult and her family left when she was maybe like 4. And they moved around, really transient lifestyle. Her dad like tried to make her a teen pop star. And she's got like this album that's very like Jewel era, like folk pop that you can see.
Damn, it's got some Smangers on it. What's going on? I got to get in though.
It's honestly pretty cool.
Great.
Like, it has her great guitar playing and stuff, but she totally disowned that. Yeah, when she was like 17, she went to Berkeley on a scholarship. But yeah, you know, it's like when they first came out, there was this kind of thing that was like, her story was the sort of thing that critics, like you were saying earlier, that is the kind of thing that I feel like if it didn't happen, critics would have invented it because it's so compelling. And there's just so much there, and there's so, it plays so much into like, you know, the indie mentality of like, I had this path and I chose this one or whatever. But, you know, I think most pieces on this new record, like that is like, that's like old news. You know, there's so much more to talk about with this band now, and where we can have these conversations that get into like the minutiae of their sound and how people respond to them. And it's like, it's cool to hear someone just, who doesn't like this band and is like pointing at things within the music, because now they have such a specific set of sounds I associate with them and different kinds of records they've made. Like, that alone to me makes them a pretty big force in indie music, or a band that refuses to be complacent.
And also, like, again, like, part of the reason I even wanted to have this conversation is like, look, you know, look, we all in our different ways, and John, you and I generationally, we understand this. It's like back in the day, we would never arbitrarily dunk on a relatively small artist.
That's totally true. Yes.
Right. And even though, like, spiritually, I believe that like a critic should be pure. And if you hate a record, doesn't matter if the person making it is Katy Perry or some 17-year-old somewhere, you know, like, I think it should be pure, but also it's like a waste of resources to dunk on a small thing that nobody's heard of.
There's a cliche in sports writing that says you should not say anything negative about an amateur athlete. And I feel like that applies to a lot of bands like this. But then the discourse happens and you can't help it. I mean, in the old days, we would just be like, hey, have you heard this band? They've got a record. They're pretty good. Here's a little thing in Spin. And that's, it would go away, you know, but this is almost an inundation of discourse with this stuff.
And that is why I felt like I had to G up and really engage with Big Thief and engage with my own blockages. Do you guys have any similar blockages with any particular artist or sound or scene? Is there anything that, like, you look at the popular conversation around and are just absolutely baffled by? Recent.
I feel like it's more the conversation kind of around culture generally is just too, I just feel like it's too crazy these days. Like, it's like, it's, I really miss the old, I guess my model of criticism and how you should sort of land it has always been like the old sort of like Village Voice. And, you know, where it's like, things are too takey now and they don't explore like what you're trying to do right now. Actually, just kind of like, what's happening with this band?
And also like an old Village Voice, like this would have been a perfect thing to do like side-by-side reviews, like one of y'all doing the kind of like Big Thief is the
show. But they wouldn't like, have to, because there'd be no internet discourse to make us have this conversation in the first
place. Wow. Big facts.
It would just be, here's 800 words by, you know, who would have been the writer in 2002? I don't even know. Whatever. It's like, you know, about how this record is pretty good. And then it'd be next to some other, you know, and like it would be close reading and kind of like, you know, what, you know, I think that people have just been sort of, and there has always been hype and there's always been, you know, there's an interesting thing to talk about, sort of like hype that makes sense and hype that seems, I think we said the fight between weirdly overrated and conventionally overrated.
Again, I think sometimes there's a perception that like a critic who like steps into the breach and says, hey, this thing that y'all love, it's not that good. It's that it has to be a corrective. I guess there were probably other circumstances where I would be like, actually, I'm trying to stop y'all and I'm trying to like really plant a flag and be like, oh, everything y'all saying is trash. But I feel like that's not how I feel in this case. I feel like it's like, you guys are all speaking in a language that I quite literally do not speak. And I'm like kind of begging for someone to subtitle it.
I mean, do you remember when The Voice ran like 4 or 5 reviews of the Lauryn Hill record?
Yes.
Like that was a landmark record that was going to change. It was by a hugely important superstar. It was clearly going to impact the next 20 years of music just by coming out. And you know, you can tell right away, like there are moments that need this kind of like, you know, back and forth and this kind of discourse. I don't know if Big Thief makes it, despite me liking them a lot.
Yes, I don't. And I don't think it is. Ultimately, I don't think it is. And that's why it's hard to like see like fever pitch discourse on Twitter and just kind of be like, is this what we're filling the days with?
We haven't answered the thing yet, which is like, why them? You know, we kind of have gotten, I think we've gotten towards it a little bit, but like, we're not doing this about Soccer Mommy. We're not doing this about Rolling Blackouts, Coastal Fever. There's lots of indie rock that comes and goes and lots of, you know, rap that comes and goes, a lot of things that come and goes. This, it did happen with this. Like, it was organic in some sense. And so, you know, here we are, I think, you know, still trying to figure out, you know, why this happened is not completely useless, because it is bigger than most.
It's just, I still think people need heroes. I'm sorry. I know it's
late. Yeah, no, right.
I do think that.
It's interesting to me because I think Big Thief appeals to me in some ways because they exist outside a lot of what we're talking about. Like, it's true that they do have a really fervent audience on social media, but it's like the band themselves don't seem caught up in that. Like, they're not the type of band where it's like, you know, where every day there's a news story of like, Adrian Lenker says this, or like,
or like, you know, like, you're right, like I was going to quit music, or this kind of stuff where it's like discursive about the album release, where it's like, what? And the music itself, the music itself stands outside of some of this stuff, like, you know, literally.
Yeah, and so that's like what I was saying with like the origin story too, where it's kind of like there are these things about them that I could see being like overblown and like coming across as a sort of like, I don't know, marketing. But the fact that the band has continually turned away from that, even like making a record like UFOF, which like we were saying, like immediately felt like a breakthrough and immediately seemed to capture a bigger audience. Instead of really luxuriating in that, they immediately put out another record to take the focus off it and put it onto this new set of songs. And if you saw them on that tour, totally different. If you saw them on that tour, they were playing totally new songs that, you know, wouldn't be out until this record. And like that element to me, when I see a band like that, I get really excited because that is not a lot of bands. Like, I mean, for one thing, most bands don't have the resources to put out as many records and spend as much time in studios. But there is a sense to this band, and it's true because even before they had the following, they worked this way where it's like, no matter what happens outside them, because the hype will die down and like the hyperbole will die down. But it's like the fact that they're so keyed in, and if you are on board with the sound, it's like, you probably like the last record. You'll probably like the next one. you know, when you see them live, you'll probably hear more new songs you like. That element to me, like as a critic and as a listener, is the kind of thing that I look for, you know, and I, in general, I try to avoid Twitter discourse because it ruins everything.
Yes, obviously, don't at Sam on Twitter and don't at John Dolan on Twitter. Like, while we're here, don't at any of us on Twitter. But but you did actually, just a quick sidebar, you used the word resources. And it reminded me of an anecdote in your interview where I don't know what year this happened, but you said there was some point where they were offered to play, like, I don't know, like a private party for like Doritos Flamin' Hot Cheetos or something, you know, like, you know, like Taco Bell Chihuahua's birthday party or something. And they could have used the money to pay some unspecified medical bills, but they declined. And I saw that and I was like, well, this is quaint as Jesus, to turn down like a private party when you are like a struggling band with medical bills. And like, I gotta be honest, I lived through the 90s. I lived through sellout
That's
culture.
That's the old values. Yeah, right.
I know, but I was also like, medical bills are real. We do not live with socialized medicine. Like, take the money. You want to tell us more about that story, Sam?
Yeah, it was Buck Meek, the guitarist, who told me that story. And he
great name. Also, just sidebar.
Also, his great solo name. Record is good.
Oh, I haven't listened to it.
Throw it in there. Yeah, I want to add
okay,
it.
Good. All right, noted.
Yeah, talented guy. But yeah, he was using it as an example of like one of the few inter-band fights they had where two members were like, yeah, with that perspective of like, look, we're not making any money from streaming or from our records, you know, like, let's do this. The other two being like, no, like, because if we are playing private parties, that means we're the type of band who like plays private events and performs in places our fans can't see us, like literally just to get the money. And ultimately they decided not to do it. And, you know, I mean, I think, yeah, there was something similar in the Rolling Stone piece where they were talking about like they're sticking to their values. But yeah, I mean, it is a quaint story, but I also think like, yeah, you know, being on 4AD and playing the level of shows they're playing and the festivals, I don't mean to say that they have have a ton of money coming in, but being at that level of indie fame allows you certain things.
Yes, but also like I want them to be healthy. You know what I mean? Like, this is also when you hit middle age, you're like, all those things that seem charming in your 20s were like, oh, we're struggling, we're on the road, you know, we're like a starving band, and that's just so, it's just a beautiful emotional thing. Like, my parents before me were in a starving indie rock band, and my grandparents before them were in a starving indie rock band with no health insurance.
How do you know that 4AD doesn't have a good health plan? We don't know what they're
No, I'm saying this is back the early days, because, you know, no shots at Saddle Creek, but like in the early days, I'm saying, like, but no, I think they're probably okay now. That'd be my guess, is they're probably okay now. But, you know, the idea that you have to like, and this is true in any creative field, it's not strictly in musicians, indie rock or whatever. This is true in writing, in fine art, you know, in, I don't know, comedy or whatever. It's true in all these places. There's like a weird romance that's a value-driven romance, but you have been sold that value set by people who would just as happily see you die. So anyway, just like throwing that out there for any other struggling indie rock bands, I'm going to say take the gig and pay the medical
bills.
Take
the Cheetos money, kid.
Take the Cheetos. Like, the Taco Bell Chihuahua only turns 26 once. Right. Only once.
Well, dog ears. Yeah, right.
That's right. Dog. Oh, my God. Okay. Guys, y'all did the damn thing. It was some big shooters on this episode. I couldn't be more grateful to both of you, really.
Thanks for having us on, John.
Yeah, I love talking about Big Thief. Any chance to go off about this band, I'll take.
Really appreciate it. That's our show. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Catch me at the Big Thief merch table at Brooklyn Steel sometime in 2023. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com. Get in the Facebook group. Get on the Discord. Subscribe anywhere you get your audio content, wherever that might be. I don't know. I gave up on audio like 6 months ago. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week. John and Sam, what's an absolute low-key banger that we should go out on? By Big Thief, I should
call. I was going to say the Avril Lavigne album, but no.
Let's go with the title track.
Beautiful.
It's a mouthful, and here it is. I believe in you. Even when you need to.
Get ultimate protection and durability for your painting project at Menards. Get a paint that combines durability and gorgeous color. Dutch Boy's DuraClean Interior Paint and Primer in 1 offers Stay Clean technology, making your home stay beautiful and clean longer. And with Dutch Boy's easy opening smooth pouring container, transforming your home has never been easier. Save big money on Dutch Boy paints and head into Menards to get your paint project started today.
Save big money at Menards.